Hello, everyone, and welcome. January is here. A new year is upon us. Our first guest of the new year, Tim.
Yeah.
I love that smell of a fresh new guest at the beginning of a new year.
It's always nice, isn't it?
It's like a new car odor.
Yeah.
You crack open those doors, take a big huff. Ah, yeah, and that's what we've got today. Stranger U.S., true paranormal stories from the United States. And we've got an interesting set of stories we're going to chat about. Again, John Olson has been a guest with us before. He is back. He lives in beautiful northern Utah, resides on the far north side of in Lewiston, I believe it is, with his wife and three kids. He enjoys the outdoors and spending his time with his family, and apparently into collecting stories of the supernatural from all around the United States. Thank God for that, Tim, because then we have somebody to talk to on the show.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it's always good way to start off the new year. Happy New Year to you, John. Thanks for being here with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, we were kind of forced to with the pictures that you have of Tim and I in compromising positions, you know as well as I do.
How he got that one shot of me, I'll never know, but good, right. Good on you, John. Good on you.
Well, you know, I got to do what I got to do, right?
That's right. Hey, you got to keep relevant. I appreciate that. So, gosh, how many is this book number four in the series?
It is. Yeah, it's book number four. So I'm really excited about it. And it just keeps going. So I'll keep writing books as long as I can collect stories. So.
Excellent. Well, let's to introduce you to audiences again, give us a little bit of your background and your fascination with the supernatural. Have you, you know, I know we have some authors and, you know, people that have been on the show who are fascinated, but have never had their own experience. Where do you come down?
So I grew up in a home that was over 100 years old. It was built in 1880. And growing up, it wasn't long before I knew that something was different about my house. And so it was very paranormally active as far back as I can remember as a child. And I grew up, my parents really didn't like us talking much about it outside of the home, just for fear of people thinking that we were crazy. So my interest in the paranormal was very piqued. And I just read everything I could get my hands on in my younger years. And as I got older, I had friends that would come over to the house and have experiences of their own. And because of that, they would ask me about the house and I would have to share my experiences. And before long, I was talking, you know, to people and sharing my experiences at parties and on double dates. And at that point, people started coming to me and sharing their experiences that they had because they felt comfortable because of the experience that I had also shared. And so it kind of started from there. By the time I was 17 or 18, I started collecting and writing down their stories. And for a long time, it was just local stories because it was just word of mouth and people I knew. And then by the time my first book came out, which was about 4 years ago, it kind of exploded with people across the country sharing their stories and coming to me. So it's just been really an amazing journey of meeting people and sharing my story and also, you know, hearing other people's story and being able to share their stories.
Now, as far as your experiences with the paranormal, and I love the fact that you'd be on double dates and they'd want stories. Did that ever scare a date off for you, John? They heard your stories once and they're like, yeah, this guy's not for me.
You know, not that I can remember. No, I've had, you know, told the stories and had people, you know, just kind of shake their head and say, I don't believe you, or, you know, it could be this or could be that. But what I found more fascinating was how many people would come back to me later. Like if I was telling the stories to, you know, a whole room full of people, how many of those people would come to me later on by themselves and say, oh, you know, I got to tell you my story because, you know, I'm afraid to tell it because people might think I'm crazy, but, you know, you seem like a normal person and you had this kind of experience. So it's actually been great to be able to just get out there and let people know that they're not alone in their experiences.
That's awesome. What a great kind of position to hold. You know, you want to share that. And that's what I feel we've always been doing with this show, is hopefully bridging that gap from people that thought they were crazy seeing and hearing and experiencing things to realize that they're not. This, maybe the paranormal is more normal than we give it credit for. Right. Now, let's revisit. This is book number four. We've got a link for it in today's program. But if you don't mind, let's revisit a couple of your favorite stories from the first three books, kind of setting the stage, and then we'll get into the next book, the new book, and see where it goes from there.
Okay, that'd be great. So, you know, I have a lot of stories that I really enjoy. One, you know, I collect not only ghost stories, but everything related to the paranormal, which, you know, includes Bigfoot and UFOs and even what I call glitches in the Matrix. One of my favorite stories from my first book was from a gentleman named John that I interviewed. And he was a manager at here in Cache Valley, actually on the Cache Valley Cache National Forest. He was a manager of this, I guess, lodge is what it is, that's up in the mountains, way up in the mountains. And he told me the story of one night he was managing the lodge, and it was in September. And so it was after the summer, not quite, you know, ski season. So there wasn't a lot of people. He only had one couple staying the night. And because it's so far up there, the managers will stay several nights and then be home several nights, kind of a three on, three off, four off kind of a thing. So he had his own room up there, the manager's room. And in the middle of the night, he came knocking at the door, the gentleman, and he went to the door and wanted to know what was going on. And he said that him and his wife wanted to check out, and the guy was scared to death. He could tell this gentleman was scared to death. And he said, well, yeah, sure. He's like, is everything okay? And he's like, no, we just want to leave. We want to leave. And he said, okay. And so he walked him down to the office and filled out the paperwork and everything. And he, once again, he's like, did we do something wrong? You know, he was worried he had done something wrong. And at that point he said, well, my wife and I were up on the balcony, and the balcony overlooks the parking lot and a big kind of field in between the trees. And he said something ran across the parking lot. And he said, and John, the manager, he said, well, you know, we've got a lot of wildlife. We're in the mountains. And the guy was quiet, and he said, no, this was on 2 feet, and it was an extremely large. And he said, oh, okay. And after he checked out the couple, they threw their stuff in their car and drove off as quick as they could. He thought that was really strange, and he went down to the office to file away the paperwork before he went back to bed. And when he turned off the light, there was a big window behind him on the desk. And when he turned off the light, there was an outline of a great big person with no neck, he said, that he could tell was standing in the window behind him. And with the moonlight, it cast a huge shadow on the wall. And he kind of got up and slipped out of the door and shut the door. And he was scared at this point. And while he was sitting there trying to figure out what to do, there came a huge bang on the back of the building that shook the entire building. And so he ran up to his room and shut and locked the door. And he's trying to figure out what he's going to do. He's afraid to call the owner and say what's going on. And he said he sat there for about an hour trying to figure out what was going on when he saw lights coming up the big driveway from the main canyon. So he ran down and opened the door, and it was a highway patrol officer that was patrolling the canyon. And the officer came in, and before he could explain what was going on, the officer said, has anybody, you know, came here or complained about, you know, something strange going on? And he kind of told him what had happened. And the officer said that they had reports of people calling saying there was somebody in a giant monkey suit running across the road not far from there. And so he thought that was really strange and talked to the officer. And he asked the officer if stuff like that happens a lot. And the officer kind of was quiet for a minute and said, well, we're not really allowed to talk about the things we see up here. And then the officer left, and the rest of the night went very quiet for him, but he found that really fascinating. When he did finally talk to the owner about what happened, the owner explained to him that when they were building the building, the workers up there would come up and find equipment moved, or they had dug up a huge boulder, which they needed a great big backhoe and truck to get out. But on several occasions, they came up and it had been moved by something up there, and they couldn't believe that something was big enough up there to move this huge boulder around on the property. But I thought that was a fascinating story. One of my favorites from all of my stories.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Something that big enough to move something that size with apparently really no effort.
Yeah.
That is crazy. Very cool. You know, in getting these stories, and now people have reached out to share and continue to share their stories with you. Do you focus on just specific areas, or are there, you know, areas that you're looking to maybe go into that you haven't covered before?
You know, it's funny because I have a lot of areas. I mean, the stories cover, you know, a vast array. And my kind of favorite genre or my favorite type of story will change, you know, as I go along, just because I will get so many different stories. And it seems to vary all over. One thing that I do find very interesting is when I meet somebody, they'll always say, you know, from across the country, they'll always say, oh, my area, the area I live in is one of the most paranormally active in the country. And so it makes me wonder if just the entire country isn't extremely paranormally active, if that makes sense. But
right. Well, yeah, it is funny. We, you know, you know, you hear Arizona, the most haunted state in America, New England, the most haunted area in America. But it's like, good God, you know, but you look at the kind of bloodshed that was spilled on our land, right? Mm-hmm. From wars and sadly purging of indigenous peoples, and then just the regular horrors of everyday life of tragic accidents and murders and death and thing that takes place. I would guess, you know, I mean, if we could wear specter detector glasses and put them on and look to see where spirits really are, we would be blown away by how many we might be able to actually see.
Yeah, I think you're right. I know that not far from where I live, to the north, is this area. It's called the Bear River Massacre. It's one of the bloodiest Native American massacres in all of the lower 48 states. And throughout my experiences of interviewing people, I've gathered quite a few stories from that area. I haven't written them out yet, just because I feel like I want to be very respectful about that, and I'm not sure exactly how to do that when I write it all out. But definitely areas like that, and there's a lot of those across the country, hold quite a bit of different energy and, I guess, spirits like that.
All right. Well, what digging into your second book, what's one of your favorite tales you tell from your second tome?
Oh, so my second book, which was Beyond Stranger Bridgerland, my first book was Stranger Bridgerland. Second book that was one of my favorites, probably, oh boy, there's so many to choose from. I know one that kind of falls out of the range, a little bit different than some of the other ones.
Please.
It was an interview I did with the gentleman from the valley here where I grew up. And it was, he was a teenager at the time. It was in the 90s. He was telling me he was dating a girl from across the mountain. And it was two nights before Halloween. And they'd been on a date and spent the evening. And he was on the way taking her home. And in the valley here, you have a lot of small towns. You have a small town, and then a little ways later, another small town. And so you have to go through these, you know, these small towns to get to wherever it is you're going usually. Well, he was going through one of the towns that is actually the first settled one in the valley. It's called Wellsville. And they were talking about Halloween and ghost stories. And he said that they were coming by the Wellsville Cemetery. And for fun, he was like, oh, I'm going to scare my girlfriend. And so he said, oh, let's drive through the cemetery. And she's like, no, I don't want to do that. And he was, yeah, this will be fun. And this is at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he pulled around and pulled into the cemetery. And as he pulled up on, his headlights hit about 20 men dressed in dark robes and a moving van that had stuff in the back of the moving van.
Oh, no, and, no.
Yeah. And
that's a horror movie trope.
I know, exactly. And he froze and she froze. And so they're down the lane. It's kind of a dirt lane because it's an older cemetery. And all of these guys are there. And he's like, yeah, it was like just almost like out of a Scooby-Doo movie. And he's staring at them and they're staring at each other. And he can't see their face because the robes are covering. And all of a sudden, it's almost as if somebody flipped a switch. They all started running towards the car. And he backed out of there and she's screaming and they drove out of there and drove down to the main street where there's a phone because, you know, back then nobody had cell phones. And he called 911 because he's like, this isn't normal. This is really out of there. So, and they sent a police car there and he just laughed after he called and told them what was going on. Well, they contacted him later because they got his information and said when they got there, they were gone. There wasn't any damage or anything, but they wanted him to know that he wasn't the first one to see this group of people in the valley at different cemeteries throughout that week doing something, but they didn't know what it was they were doing. And so coming from this area and growing up here at that time, that's really, really unusual. I mean, you don't have a group of 20 people in robes in the cemetery in the middle of the night. I mean, it just really kind of strange and out there for sure. But what they were doing, I have no idea. So.
No. You know, when I was a kid, we had a haunted pet cemetery near our home, and we heard these stories all the time. And I've told this before, but it's been a while. I'll refresh. And we went there with my buddy driving it, and his girlfriend in the front seat, and me and my girlfriend in the back seat. And, you know, of course, you want to get that kind of adrenaline kick going, get your girl to scooch in a little bit closer. So talking spooky stuff. And we're like, oh, we know a really creepy place. We're going to go to the haunted pet cemetery. Yeah. Oh, no, don't go there. And we go driving and we get in and we turn off the lights as we turn on the little road, the gravel road to go down into the pet cemetery. And we drive in there. We're just sitting there and we're telling the stories of things that you could hear and experience in this pet cemetery when suddenly we heard something.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Paul, who was driving, looked over at me quizzically and then he reached over and pulled the lights on. And this was an old car, so he pulls the light switch on. There is a guy standing in a freshly dug grave and he turns and looks at us. Yeah. There was quite a loud scream in the car. Who's at a pet cemetery in the middle of the night digging holes? Right?
Oh, my goodness.
Nothing good can come from that. We flew out of there, backed out of there quick, and went scrambling. So it was one of those holy shit minutes that you get. You're like, you know, this is a horror movie come true. What did we just witness? And to this day, I should probably go back there and tell cops and point out this area and say what we saw, but it 35 years later. But wouldn't that be something if they go down there, do a little ground penetrating radar and find a human remains in one of the graves there? Oh God.
Right.
First of all, I'd feel about it. But second of all, yikes. Yeah, that was
exactly.
That was a weird as hell moment for all of us. So I love that you've got a story. It's kind of in that same vein. Tim, could you imagine when we had our apartment in college, and I was gone, I asked Tim to line up our next apartment, and he did, and it was across the street from a cemetery. And how happy was I about that, Tim?
You weren't happy at all, no.
No, we didn't last there very long. But could you imagine had we come home one night from doing Sunday Night Softly on the radio station there, and then be walking home and see a bunch of cloaked figures in that cemetery? I can't even.
Yeah, that would be crazy.
Well, we used to, you know, in Winona, there was the big cemetery, Tim, there, kind of by Sugarloaf. Do you remember that cemetery? Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. Yep. Beautiful, beautiful area, but it's this very hilly range. And you used to just kind of go up there with girls and park. And I mean, allegedly, Tim and I were too busy raising money for charity.
Right. And reading Bible verses. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we used to go play tag in the cemetery.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You'd be boogieing through the cemetery, and this was an old cemetery, and some of the vaults had been cracked open, and you could see skeletal remains in a few of them. Mm. And I remember taking a header as I'm chucking through, and I hit my foot on a gravestone and hit the ground, and I realize I'm looking down into a broken tableau, one of those the covers, and you could see inside, and there was bones. And I think that was the one and done time I ever had playing I think we called it Ghost in the Graveyard, the game of tag at that cemetery. But again, we were looking for horror movie problems, right? You don't run around in a dark cemetery by yourself that's hilly and lots of areas for creepy guys in robes and Jason Voorhees to be hanging out, because you just don't know what's coming next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, during the day, I kind of like looking around cemeteries and reading the headstones and wondering about people's lives, but nighttime is definitely a different thing for sure.
Yeah, I'm never a big fan of cemeteries anyway. I think it really comes down to is, we joke a lot on the show about the zombie apocalypse, which is going to happen, but I'm more worried about, I don't want to bump into ghosts at a cemetery. I really don't, because to me that's tragic. Why would you stay with your corpse?
Right.
In a cemetery. I want to be, in a movie theater, watching my favorite play, hanging with my kids, harassing my wife, whatever I could do from the other side. I just don't see hanging out in a cemetery. That's terrifying to me. And it's too real, when you experience those stories. All right. So we've got a little taste from book one and book two. Let's take a dive into book three. What was one of your favorite kind of standout unusual stories from that?
So one type of story that I seem to gather quite a bit of honestly, when I wrote my first book and I told my first black-eyed kid story in there. It was amazing after that book came out, how many people contacted me and said, oh my goodness, I didn't know about this phenomenon, but I had this experience and I thought I was alone. And one of those was Andrew, who contacted me with his black-eyed story kid, or a black-eyed kid story. He was living in Boise at the time, Boise, Idaho, and he would travel for implementation. He did. He would go all different places. He worked for a company that did software. So he would go and spend a couple days to a week at a company that had bought their software. And he would go and show them how it works and get it all hooked up. And at one point he was in Montana, Bozeman, Montana, and had done an implementation, and he got done a day early. And he had driven. It's quite a long ways from Boise to Bozeman, but if he drove, I think he was telling me if he didn't fly, his company paid him extra money or something for driving, and he really didn't mind driving. And so he left late from Bozeman, planning on getting home, early in the morning to Boise. And as he traveled, he ended up having to get off of the main highway because of an accident. And so he looked up where he was going, and there was a road that travels. It's almost a shortcut from where the highway would go, but because it's a two-lane road, it's slower. But it goes right above an area called Craters of the Moon, I believe is what it's called, National Park, which has got its own creepy stories that go along with it. But he was getting low on gas, and it was around, you know, 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and he stopped at this little tiny town to get gas. And the gas station was closed, but he had his credit card, so he pulled into the gas station. And when he pulled in, there was two kids standing just outside the parking lot, which he found really strange that they would be out in the middle of the night. But he kind of tried to, you know, ignore this. And he started filling up his car. And all of a sudden, the little girl, there was a little boy and a little girl. The boy looked a little bit older. She was all of a sudden right near the car, and he didn't even see her come up, and was asking for a ride. She was about 8 or 9 years old, and said, you know, we live up the road, we need a ride home. And she was asking, you know, we lost our mother. Can you take us for a ride up the road to find our mom? And he just got this really dark, horrible feeling about the whole situation. He's like, no, I don't know your mom. I don't know you guys. I'm just passing through, you know? And she's like, can't you help us find our mom? And she's doing it in this sweet little girl voice, but something inside of him is just screaming, get out of there, you know? And he ends up, you know, telling her no and getting in the car. And as soon as he gets in the car, the little boy is on the other side, and he's like, you know, that's not fair. Please help us. You can't turn us down. We're little kids, which to him sounded really strange. And at that point, when he looked up at the little boy, he could see the little boy's eyes were jet black. And, he just, at that point lost it, which anybody would, threw the car in gear and drove off. And the last thing he saw of the kids, he looked in the rearview mirror. They're both standing under the light at the gas station, just staring at him. And he had heard one of my stories and on the radio, and he had not heard of the black-eyed kid phenomena before. And he thought he was alone and had kept a hold of that story for quite a while all to himself. But when he heard, he had to, you know, he wanted to contact me and give me his story. But I find all of those, the black-eyed kid stories, fascinating and freaky all at the same time.
What do you make of them? Because again, you know, your situation seems very similar to ours. We were introduced to this story by, I think it was Jason Offutt. Am I correct in that, Tim? Or was it David Weatherly?
I think it was Jason Offutt, if I remember.
Right.
Yeah.
Who introduced us kind of like you're doing, telling us a bunch of weird stories. And then he kind of broke into the Black Eyed Kids stories. And then all of a sudden, this floodgate of stories came pouring in. Now, what's strange to me is a bunch of stories came in, you know, over the period of the next year. Mm-hmm. And then it's one or two here and there. And it's been very sporadic since. Now, I know that many people have turned their stories over to Jason and David Weatherly and you and people like that that are presenting them in book form. So maybe that's why we're not hearing as many now. We have people begging us constantly. When are you going to do another all Black Eyed Kids encounter show? We'd love to do it because they're creepy as hell and they're great stories. But what do you make of it? Do you think this is following more of the urban legend, the myth of this happening, and that is bigger than the story itself, that people are creating it to become part of the mythos?
I think it could be a combination of both. I do know that when I interview people, part of, you know, when I put a story in my book, it has to be somebody that I've interviewed that it happened to them personally. And so the people that I interview that tell me their stories, I can definitely feel, you know, the fear in their voice and understand what's going on. And so, you know, it's hard to tell. I'm sure there is now like a big mythos out there and kind of the boogeyman kind of thing that people talk about when they get out there, because it's the same sort of thing with, you know, Slender Man or something like that, in that, somebody actually, you know, if I'm not mistaken, somebody made up the story of Slender Man, but it's taken on a
right
persona,
right,
of its own kind of a thing. So is it, I think it would be almost like the fact that whatever's out there is taking on this this visage, and using the mythos of it in for its own use, probably. Not necessarily that people are making it up, though I'm sure there might be people out there making up their own stories, but almost like there's this dark energy that takes the form of whatever we give it. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's definitely fascinating.
Right. You know, kind of a turn between tulpas and then just exploitative, I don't know if you want to call them demonic or dark energies that are taking these visions to scare people and affect right. them more deeply because they know it's part of the lexicon. Same thing with aliens, right? Aliens were very human looking for quite a while. Then they became kind of the big bulbous head grays. And then as one other person suddenly talks about them being like jellyfish, suddenly a bunch of people see the jellyfish versions. It makes me wonder if these beings are taking on the images that they see are affecting people in the most peculiar ways and more horrifying ways.
Yeah, that could definitely be something along those lines. It's really kind of fascinating to think of because I know that especially when you get into the area of the fae or, you know, I guess, you know, little people or however you want to, you know, want to talk about fairies and stuff like that. When I do my research, especially if I get a story and I want to, after I get the story, I want to research history to see if there's any connection with anything. I think it's the same kind of deal. Because oddly enough, you have like Native American history and folklore. And even though they have different names for things, the explanation is very similar all the way around the world to these creatures that, or these spirits that inhabit the woods or inhabit the world, but they just have different names for it. So I think it goes along those kind of lines now that we're in our own age and we're coming up with our own mythos and our own folklore, and it all kind of weaves together. Now we have, you know, black eyed kids and the shadow people and different things like that, that our mind is interpreting just the same way that our ancestors did from around the world. We're just kind of making our own folklore and mythology going along.
With that said, with the research you did, were you able to uncover any stories, especially of Native American, indigenous people stories, that there is a black-eyed kid-like character in their mythos as well?
You know, not in particular black-eyed kids. I know that I have interviewed people who've had experiences with creatures in the woods, and then I'm able to go back and pin down that creature to a Native American folklore or Native American creature that they talk about, and they're very similar, whether it's a skinwalker or whether it's a they all kind of left my mind at the moment, but nothing black-eyed kid wise, but there are definitely connections with other stories.
All right. That was a great place. We'll take a quick break. And when we return, folks, let's take a look into the new book. Our guest today, John Olson. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. And this, of course, is Darkness Radio. Speaking of published and getting it out there, Stranger US, True Paranormal Stories from the United States. Our guest today, John Olson, as we're talking about his book series. We've talked about some of your favorite stories from the first three books. Now let's take a look into the new book and some of the newer stories, maybe even touching on a couple of different aspects from each one. Bigfoot, UFO, ghosts, other cryptids. Where shall we begin this next part of our journey together, John?
You know, it's got a good smattering, at least I believe, of all different kinds of stories and from all different, you know, aspects of life. One that kind of stands out to me as different and not your kind of average story, came to me by Josie. And Josie, I was able to contact Josie through a friend of mine who came to me and said, oh, I know somebody who's got a story. If you can get her to tell you, it would be great for your book. And so after a little prodding and hunting down, I was able to contact Josie, and she agreed to share her story. Josie grew up in the southern part of Idaho in a very rural area in the early 80s and 90s. And she when she grew up, they weren't very well off. They didn't have a lot of money. But when she turned 10 years old, she told her mom and dad, only thing she wanted for her birthday was a dog. She wanted a puppy really bad. And she wasn't even sure, she said at the time, that she would be able to get a puppy. But sure enough, on her birthday, right near the end of school, so the end of May, beginning of June, she came home from school and her parents had found a puppy for her. And she was so excited. It was a Collie Labrador lab mix. And she said that it had a white S on its chest, which was really kind of unusual kind of marking. And so she named the dog Sammy. And she's talking about how much she loved that dog. And through the whole summer, she trained Sammy, you know, to shake and sit. And she trained, you know, the dog to do all these tricks and just absolutely loved this dog to death. Around August, one of the things her family did to help through the winter is they had a wood burning stove. And so as a family, they always had to go up into the mountains and cut wood. And it was kind of a big family affair that they would go up on Saturday for a couple of Saturdays and gather wood for the winter. And so she took Sammy with, and they went up in the mountains, and the morning was pretty kind of uneventful. And the dog stayed with her the whole time. She said it was her job to load the little pieces and clean up. And she was doing that. And all of a sudden she realized the dog wasn't around anymore. And so she looked everywhere and called the dog, and she got the whole family involved in looking, and she spent the rest of the day looking for the dog, but the dog had just disappeared. It was gone. And she was devastated, and it got dark, and they went home, and she was in tears, and she even convinced her dad to go up the next day on Sunday and help her look, and they went back to the same area and never found, you know, the dog. And so she said it took her a long time to get over the loss of her dog, and her parents offered to get her another dog, and she didn't want another dog. She wanted her dog. And well, jump forward 5 years, she's 15 years old, and it's fall again in August, and the family, or her dad and her brother, are going to get wood, and her dad makes her go, and she's been able to get out of it most of the time because, you know, she's devastated about her dog and losing it, but she finally has to go. And they go up, and she said they went to the exact same area where she had lost the dog, and she complained to her dad, and he said, well, this has got the best dead wood. I'm sorry, you know, we'll be able to load up the quickest here. And so they got there, and her dad and brother were running the chainsaw and knocking down the trees, and she was waiting for her turn to go and start loading. And she said she was sitting by the truck, and at this point, I want to point out that she stops in the story when she's telling this the first time, and she says, you're going to think the rest of my story is crazy. And I said, well, I've heard a lot of stories, and she goes, you got to believe that this is really what happened. And I said, okay. And she said she looked, and there was a dog coming up the road towards her. And she looked, and as I got closer, she realized it looked more and more like her dog. And as it got to her, she's like, oh, it's my dog. And she scooped up the dog. It had the little S on the chest. It had the collar that she had bought the dog with Sammy on it, and it looked brand new. She asked the dog to do tricks. It did the tricks like it had remembered the whole time. And she's just hugging the dog and crying. And her dad comes around the corner. He goes, "What are you doing? I've been calling you forever." And she goes, "Look, I found my dog." And her dad was really skeptical. He's like, "That can't be your dog, you know?" And for the rest of the day, she refused to leave the dog. She took the dog and put it in the truck and sat with the dog the rest of the day. She wouldn't leave the dog. And when they got home, she showed her mom, and her mom wouldn't believe her either. She's like, "Somebody's playing a trick or something." And she showed her mom that the dog knew to do the tricks. And so the next day, or on the Monday, that was on a Saturday, she said on Monday, her mom took her and the dog to the vet. And her mom says, "I just want the dog checked out to see what the dog, you know, what's going on." And she goes, "Well, that's fine, Mom, but I know it's Sammy, you know." And the dog, or the vet checked her out, and he said, "Well," he says, you've got a healthy dog here. She's only about 4 or 5 months old. She's not going to get any bigger, but she seems really smart and healthy." And her mom, from then on, her mom refused to believe it was Sammy, but she did. She knew it was the same dog. And she had the dog for another 13 years, she said, and it lived to a ripe old age and then passed away. And she says, "I know it sounds strange, but it's almost as if the dog walked around the truck and then just reappeared 15 years or 5 years later." Wow. She says, "I know that it sounds extremely strange, but it's the truth." She said, "It is the truth. That is what happened to me." So, and I found that just really fascinating, because I hear and read a lot of stories about the strange, and in interview people about the strange things that go on in the mountains and with portholes and people getting lost and just the strange things that go on. And so I just find it mind blowing that, you know, if she's telling the truth, which I believe that she feels she's telling the truth, that something extraordinary happened to that dog. So
that's amazing. That's quite the story. Do you have another similar story like that, or where are we going next?
So, for some reason, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that I guess I do a lot of things in the wilderness, and a lot of the people that I talk to seem to do, you know, have a lot of things that go on in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. Another story, which went along a lot with Native American folklore, is from Brianne. I interviewed Brianne. This has actually been quite a few years ago. A couple of years ago, I met her. I was at an event in central Utah telling the stories and talking about my books. And she came up to me and wanted to share her story. And I was so glad that I found her. It was in the late 80s. And she'd moved here to Utah from Montana and met her husband, got married. And when they were first married, they loved to go hiking. That was their thing. And they would go up in the Uinta Mountains. And in Utah, the Uinta Mountains start near Salt Lake and then head east. And if you've ever heard of, which I know you've heard of, the Skinwalker Ranch that Yes. lies in the Uinta Mountains, Yep. Back towards the east. And they went on a hike, and they were going to go camping, and they found a spot near a place called Notch Lake, where they hiked into. And as they went in there, you know, everything seemed normal, everything seemed fine, and they pitched their tent near camp or near the lake, Notch Lake. And the first night, just as they got camp set up, it started to rain, so they ended up sitting in their tent and eating just some dry food and talking and then going to bed. And in the middle of the night, she got woken up to this sound. And she said it sounded like a high-pitched baby whining, kind of crying, coming from the lake. And she said it was really strange. And I sat up, and she sat up, and she's listening to this strange noise echoing, you know. And she woke her husband up. And as he woke up, he only got to hear it for just a little bit, and then it quit. And he said, "Oh, I think it was a mountain lion or something like that." And she wasn't so sure, but he fell back to sleep, and she sat listening, and she realized at that point too, that as the sound was going on, a lot of the other sounds in the wilderness had stopped. And as it got quiet again, and a little bit later, you know, the crickets started again and the bugs started again and the regular sounds. So the next day they got up and they hiked around the lake and spent the day, and they built a fire and had just a normal day and went back to bed. And again, in the middle of the night, she woke up to this screaming, crying sound coming from the lake. And she woke her husband up, and he was listening, and he's like, yeah, I don't know what that is. And he got up and grabbed the flashlight and put his boots on. And she's like, where are you going? And he's like, I'm going to go find out what's making that sound. And she's like, well, you're crazy. And he's like, well, do you want to stay here alone or do you want to come with me? And she didn't want to stay alone. So she threw on her boots and they went out, and she said they had an older flashlight and the beam was kind of a little bit dim. If you remember the flashlights from the 80s, they're not these nice ones that we have now, but it was working.
Don't you ever
well enough
ever pick on these. No, I know it's right. No, those flashlights that put out like light in a circle, but the middle's kind of still murky. Yeah, right. I remember those kind of flashlights.
Yep, exactly. They followed the trail down towards the lake. And actually, when they got out, the flashlight wasn't working great. But it was light enough with the moon and everything. They turned the flashlight off and followed the trail down and got to the edge of the water. That's when they could kind of see something on the edge of the lake. And that's when her husband flipped on the light and shined on this creature. And she said that it looked like almost like you would think of the weird mermaids that you've heard of, not like, you know, the nice looking ladies on top and fish on the bottom, but, it was part in the water and part on the rock. It was gray, green, huge eyes. And it had been crying, you know, screaming from the shoreline. But when the light hit it, it stopped to look at them, and had stringy, weird hair on the top. And it sat there long enough for them to get, you know, a really good look at it, about 4 foot long, she said. And then all of a sudden it turned, and in a flash, it was gone. And she was really freaked out about it. And they slowly made their way back to the tent and sat up all night listening, and it never came back. But then they left as early as they could.
They went back to the tent and stayed.
Yeah, they stayed. She said that they didn't sleep, but they stayed in the tent listening all night. They were really freaked out, but they didn't want to leave in the middle of the night either. And that's what I asked her too. I said, I don't know if I could have stayed. And she goes, yeah. She goes, at the time, you know, we felt like whatever it was in the water, and we kind of talked about what we'd seen, and because we were together, we decided to wait till light. But yeah, I was kind of the exact same way you were, wigged out about it. But after she, you know, told me this, and I got her story, and I was aware of the Native American folklore about. And I always slaughter the name, Powapix is what it's kind of said. Powapix, which is translated into water babies. They are supposedly, you know, all over in the Uintas. This is according to Indian folklore. And they mimic the voice of a baby to draw women in, and supposedly will attack and drown them. They will also mimic, female voice to draw the warriors in and drowned them as well. And it's just kind of fascinating too, because if you go through Utah history and stuff, they talk about, you know, the sounds that people have heard at the lakes and associated with that, and in the Uintas, in the mountains, in the Uintas, these strange creatures, and they go back as far as, like I said, the Native American lore. But it was really great to be able to get a first person account of someone who had seen one. So, that's one of my favorite stories, but yeah,
no. More reasons to avoid the out of doors. At all costs, my friends. Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. Yeah, I don't, you know, people go missing in the out of doors. They encounter, first of all, real creatures and monsters that are bears and lions and rabid mongoose. I don't know if that's true, but you know, there's enough really weird, creepy stuff out there that would keep me away from it. And then you start adding to this, these, water babies and Bigfoot and dogmen and chupacabras. I think, what more do you need from the universe to tell you don't go into the wild?
Right. I tell you, when I was growing up, you know, I loved the wilderness. That's where I spent a lot of my time. And as a teenager, when all my friends were skipping class to go to the mall or go this, I would skip class to go in the mountains, hiking and fishing. And so, but after, the more I've interviewed people about things in the wilderness, the more I'm like, you know, I really don't feel comfortable going alone anymore up in the mountains, even though I've done it for years. You just never know what you're going to run into.
Yeah. Yeah, that's enough reason for me to avoid going out into the out of doors ever again. Thanks for that good story. Oh, and right. You know what? Then you add to it water, right? I don't like, you know, I swam in lakes and rivers growing up and ponds. And now that I've done True Crime Tuesday, Tim laughs at me because I no longer see the beauty of an outdoor lake. I see a body dumping ground.
Right.
Yeah, and then to know that there's other creepy creatures down there trying to draw us in and pull us down, I don't know. Yeah, that's do you ever put yourself out there? Do you go to a location where people have had these experiences to go try to validate, see if there's any truth to these tales?
Yeah, if it's close enough, if it's someplace that is close enough for me to get to, I definitely love to go and get the feel of the area and kind of understand what happened I do definitely love to go visit those, and I've visited a lot of them, at least the ones that are close. So not necessarily at night, I would say, but but I do definitely like to get to the places and so that I can get the feel and when I'm writing the story and get their understanding of the situation. So,
oh, that's funny. Wow. Well, yeah, good on you for being the one to collect these stories so that we can read it from the safety of our own homes.
Right.
Again, the book Stranger US, True Paranormal Stories from the United States. We have a link up on today's program so that you can order the book. And when you do that, just go in through our links, make sure you purchase the books, and then you can find his other books while you're in there. Continue to purchase them under our link. A very small portion goes to your friends at Darkness Radio without affecting the retailer or the seller of the items. Just part of our little camaraderie that we do working with Amazon. So remember that when you're making your purchase. All right. Now, where do we go next? Do we have any good UFO alien encounters you want to share?
So one that I did, which I got from a gentleman named Stan, he shared his story with me. He lives in Wyoming, and he travels for work as well. Around a lot and all over Wyoming and part of Idaho, and he's moving quite a bit. And he told me that one time, an experience he had, he lived in Rock Springs, Wyoming, which is on the west side, and he had been clear over on the east side of Wyoming doing some work for his company. And he got off from work on a Friday and wanted to make it home. He didn't want to spend another night in the hotel. So he started on his way home. And if you know much about Wyoming, at least that area, the southern part of Wyoming, it's sagebrush. It's a lot of sagebrush and rolling hills, and there's not much out there. As he was traveling, he got quite a ways and he started, you know, getting tired. And he said, well, you know, maybe I'll pull off somewhere and just take a little rest and then get back on the road when I feel a little more refreshed. And so he pulled off and, you know, laid back in his seat and just, you know, closed his eyes. And the next thing he remembers is kind of a low rumbling sound and just an odd noise. And so he wakes up and there's just this really weird vibration in the truck and kind of, you know, weird feeling going on. And he looked out his window of his truck, the front, and above him, he could see something, you know, above the truck. So he got out and looked, and because of the outline of the stars and the lights on the bottom, he could see a triangle UFO. And I asked him how big it was, and he said, I could not tell if it was a smaller craft that was really close to me or a really large craft that was further up. He said it was really hard for me to tell, but because of the three lights and the way it blocked out the stars, because out there in the middle of nowhere, there's no light pollution, and you can see really well the Milky Way and everything, and he could see the outline of this black triangle. And this hum that he could feel, he wasn't sure what the sound was, but he could feel it as much as hear it, he said. And it slowly made its way across in front of his vehicle and then over and through, you know, the rolling hills. He could see it move. And then eventually the lights on the bottom went out and he lost all contact with it. And it was traveling southwest, he said. But he watched it for quite a while, just out there in the middle of the desert, in the middle of the Wyoming flatlands. And he said it was amazing to see, because something that large, whether it was even a smaller one close or whether it was huge and up there further, the fact that it was able to stay up in the air and just move so, you know, so slowly. And he said it was very amazing. And I asked him if he knew about, you know, the large triangle UFOs that had been seen all over. And he had heard of the Arizona lights. But he said it didn't seem as big as the they talked about on there, but it was definitely large and moving that way. And I found that really fascinating, that it woke him up somehow, that he was able to wake up from a sleep because of that static hum that was going on in his truck. But
that's cool. Now I've got to ask you, because obviously, you know, we talked a little bit about the Black Eyed Kids, mm-hmm. In the last segment, and you've written a new book. Do we have any new Black Eyed Kids stories you can share with us? Because our listeners are voracious for this.
Yes.
Their appetite is unyielding where it comes to Black Eyed Kids.
Yeah, I did interview a gentleman and his wife. They had been, a couple that loved the outdoors and planning hikes, and they had gone on a hike again in Wyoming. This one happened in Wyoming, in an area, it's called the Wind River Range, and it's a wilderness area. And you have to plan your trip and contact the natural resources and everything to make your plans to go in there, because they want it to where you feel like you're all alone up there, no matter how far in you hike. And so they did that. And as they were hiking in, he said he noticed that at first he could tell there was something following them in the tree line as they were hiking along the trail. And he didn't want to say anything to his wife to begin with, just because he didn't know what it was and he didn't want to upset her. And after a few minutes, she's like, have you seen that? There's something following us in the tree line. And he's like, yeah, I saw that. And they weren't alarmed at this point, but they kept going. And they were doing basically a 25 mile hike in, and then they were going to spend a couple days and then 25 out, which is a long hike. At one point, a gentleman steps out from the trees between these two trees, and he's wearing a white shirt, and as he's explaining to me what kind of clothes he's wearing with his hat, he's like, it looked like Amish clothes, is how he explained it. And he said it was really weird to see somebody up there in the mountains in Amish clothes. And so he went off the trail to go talk to this gentleman to find out what was going on. And right before he got close enough to talk to the gentleman, he stepped into the trees and disappeared, like just seemed to disappear into the trees. And so he went back to his wife, and they hiked up a little bit further and still had this feeling that they were being followed in the trees. And at this point, I asked him, I'm like, did you think about going back and leaving? And he said, well, we were really thinking about that at this point. We'd planned this trip forever. But we got to this area where it was wide open, and you could see around you for a long ways as you went along this trail and you were hiking up in. And he says, we got to that point, and whoever, whatever it was, stopped following us. We didn't see anybody the rest of the day. So we hiked way back in and set up our camp, and we felt fine about it. And I said, okay. And he says, we spent the night. Everything seemed great. He says, I got up in the morning and walked down the trail, put my shoes on and walked down the trail to the little lake near where they were camped, because he was going to go fishing. And down by the lake, a little girl steps out in a homemade white dress, not very far from him. Same situation. Now it's a little girl. And he called out to her, and she didn't say anything. And again, he walks towards her to try and figure out what's going on. And she walks into the trees and disappears. And at this point, he's like, nope, we're done. We're 25 miles back in here, and I don't know what's going on. So when he hurried back to camp, and his wife's like, I'm seeing that movement again. He says, our friends are back. He said, let's go. And so they threw, you know, their packs together and headed out. And again, they're seeing movement between the trees, that people are following them in the trees. And they get to a point, and again, a younger person steps out between the trees, and in Amish old style clothes. And this time he charges towards the kid to find out what's going on. And he gets close enough this time that he sees that their eyes look black. It looks like they have black eyes. And he notices that right before this kid steps into the tree line again and completely disappears. And he can't see tracks. He can't see anything. And so he runs back to his wife, and he dumps everything out of their pack that they don't need as essential. He said all their food, just enough water to get out. He's like, I want to go as fast as I can out of there. And so they did, and he put his wife in front of him and said, you go as fast as you feel like you can, and I will keep behind you. And so they hiked out, and again, through most of the way out, they felt like they were being followed, that people were watching them from the trees, movement between the trees, tree line, and they got up and out of there. But I associate that definitely with the the black-eyed kids, just because he mentioned that, you know, it seemed like the eyes were black when he did finally get close enough and a close enough look. And even though they never talked to them, again, it's another reason that you question when you go into the wilderness. You have no idea what you're going to run into.
Mm-mm. That's the stuff. That's the stuff that makes you sit there scratching your head and shaking your head and going, nah, I don't need it. Don't need it. Not important enough for my life to deal with this.
Right.
You've got a lot of great stories in the book. How many stories total do you cover in the new one?
I'm trying to think exactly how many I had in there. 25, I believe, 25 or 26, if I remember correctly, maybe a little bit more than that, actually. So, it seems like every time I do a book, they end up being a little bit longer and a little bit longer, just because I'm getting so many stories. So
has there been a story that you haven't included that you wish you would have?
I do have stories that, you know, I still may add in someday. I keep them all, you know, in files, and I've got files. When I get ready to write up my stories, and when I get ready to add them to the new book, I have my wife and my editor help me go through and decide which stories to go in and which haven't. I do have a lot of stories. I tell people this all the time. I do have a stack of stories that are, they seem to be a little bit more towards the darker side or more demonic kind of thing. And I kind of am wary of writing about them for some reason. But someday maybe I will, you know, do a whole book about those or feel more comfortable about writing them. I guess maybe my fear is I don't want to necessarily encourage people to poke in that area, I guess. But I definitely have stories from people who have done things that they wish they hadn't, looking for the paranormal.
Can you give us a little taste?
So I interviewed this girl once that her boyfriend had talked her into doing a Ouija board seance. And she, in her story, when I interviewed her, you know, at first her whole thought was, you know, this is, it's just silly anyway. You know, you move it around or he's moving around. There was actually four of them. It was two couples that were doing it at the time. And she went very quickly from somebody who was skeptical and a non-believer into understanding that there are forces out there that are beyond our control. During the time they were playing with the Ouija board, she was convinced somebody was moving the planchette, and it started mentioning things that only she knew, or at least only she thought she knew. And then at that point, she didn't want to do it anymore. She wanted to play. And then for days later, she was haunted at night from a dark entity that would come into her room and terrorize her. And it took her quite a while of, you know, getting some help to get that taken care of and unattached from her. So that's kind of a little snippet of some of the stories on the darker side that I've actually been able to gather.
Very cool. Well, you know, we appreciate you coming on. It's a great way to kick off the new year. A bunch of creepy stories, fun paranormal tales to share. And folks, we've only really scratched the surface of any of these stories. There's so many more stories in each one of his books. You had just a little smattering, a taste from each one, and you'll be checking. Are you working on your next book already?
Yeah, I am. I've been putting stories together and getting them written up. And so hopefully I'm looking again for July or August for my next one. So it just keeps going and I love doing it. So,
well, you'll have to visit with us again and catch us up on the other strange incidents around the United States with the supernatural twists. It's always a pleasure catching up with you, John. Thank you so much for coming on and spending some time with us. And we wish you and your family a very, very happy new year.
And to you guys, too. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, folks. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. That's it. Stay tuned for more of the best of paranormal talk radio tomorrow. We'll be back next week with more brand new episodes. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.